I wanted to find, if possible, the most successful bank robber in history, or at least one of. And I stumbled upon a story of this guy in Seattle who had robbed, I think, 30 banks in 52 weeks, was finally arrested. But it was a small story in the Seattle Times. There wasn't really a lot about him. His name was Anthony Hathaway. Really no biographical information. I think it may have referenced that possibly he had a drug problem. And so I wrote to him in prison, and he wrote me back and basically told me his story, and it was like so much more than I was expecting. You know, so I was expecting to do almost like a fun, what's the difference between a successful bank robber and all the ones who get caught? And what it turned out to be was the story of a life that falls apart because of his addiction to OxyContin, which he got because he hurt himself and was prescribed the medicine by his doctor. And in that sense, it's the story of millions of Americans, and not just Americans, people around the world.
Welcome to the Wheel With It podcast with your host, Devin. At Wheel With It, we are dedicated to exploring DEI issues in a fair, balanced, and fun way. Let's get into the episode.
Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Wheel With It. I am your host, Devin Wieters, and today we have Josh Dean on the podcast. Josh Dean is the founder of Campside Media and the host of one of my favorite podcasts that I've listened to recently. And if any of you are true crime fans like I am, I don't know how this works, forgive me, but I guess Campside Media has partnered up with this podcast channel called The Binge, or they started their own called The Binge, and they have some of the most amazing true crime podcasts, so definitely listen to anything by them. But back to today, the Hooked podcast tells the story of Tony Hathaway, who became a bank robber to support his habit after he became addicted to opioids. And I know you guys are going to be amazed by this guy's story like I was, because Tony ended up turning his life around, and we get into all that. So I know you guys are going to be amazed by this guy's story. I was like, as soon as I heard the Hooked podcast, I was like, you need to come on and talk about this. So here's my conversation with Josh Dean. Hope you enjoy. Hello, welcome to another episode of Wheel With It. My name is Devin Wieters, and today we have Josh Dean. He is the host of the Hooked podcast, and it chronicled a father and son that got wrapped up in the opioid epidemic. And I love the podcast so much that I reached out to him and was like, hey, will you come on and talk about this? And he graciously agreed to be here. So, Josh, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to talk about this project.
Tell us about yourself, and then we'll go from there.
So most of my career as a print journalist, so like a magazine feature writer and author. But then I don't want to say I pivoted to podcasts, but I made a podcast in 2019 called The Clearing that was very successful. And then shortly after that, started a company with two other print journalists and a film producer called Campside Media, and we make serialized nonfiction limited series. Serial was the original model for what we do, and these are 6 to 10 part stories, like stories you would read in a book, which is what we used to do it and still do. But Hooked was one of our first. So Campside's now made about, I don't know, 30 of these, and Hooked was in our first 10, I think.
So how did you come across this story? Because fascinating, and I can imagine coming across that and being like, I think we have a story here.
Yeah, I'm a generalist. Like, I don't specialize in anything. I follow my curiosity. And so I've written and now podcasted about all kinds of subjects. And mostly they're like just people who live in worlds that I'm fascinated with. And in this case, I fell into it through a trap door because I was actually looking for a story about a bank robber. I used to write quite a bit for Bloomberg Businessweek, and they do a heist issue every year, and I participate in this, and they had asked me to like look for ideas. And so what I was looking for actually was an objectively successful bank robber. I wanted to find, if possible, the most successful bank robber in history, or at least one of. And I stumbled upon a story of this guy in Seattle who had robbed, I think, 30 banks in 52 weeks, was finally arrested. But it was a small story in the Seattle Times. There wasn't really a lot about him. His name was Anthony Hathaway. Really, no biographical information. I think it may have referenced that possibly he had a drug problem. And so I wrote to him in prison, and he wrote me back and basically told me his story. And it was like so much more than I was expecting. You know, so I was expecting to do almost like a fun, what's the difference between a successful bank robber and all the ones who get caught? And what it turned out to be was the story of a life that falls apart because of his addiction to OxyContin, which he got because he hurt himself and was prescribed a medicine by his doctor. And in that sense, this story of millions of Americans, and not just Americans, people around the world, but it's especially a problem in the US, that starting in the early 2000s through the mid 2000s, I think it's still going on today, but I think doctors at least are much more aware of it, and it's harder to prescribe these things in the volumes that they used to. But for 10 or 15 years, doctors were addicting people unknowingly and then knowingly. And Tony was this guy who had a great life and then got addicted to a medicine his doctor gave him, and his life fell apart.
Yeah. And can you describe how he first got prescribed them and then what happened afterwards?
Yeah, of course. He was a Boeing engineer. So he was a airplane designer. He designed galleys for Boeing inside this factory north of Seattle in Everett. I believe it's the largest building on Earth, bigger than the Pentagon, or maybe second to the Pentagon, this enormous airplane design facility, actually manufacturing facility, but they also have design. And one day he would play roller hockey in the parking lot after work with his coworkers. And one day, I don't remember exactly what year, we're talking early 2000s, he falls while playing roller hockey, injures his back pretty badly, has back surgery, like it can't get out of bed, like nothing is helping. And his doctor prescribes him this thing called OxyContin. And it's a miracle drug, right? It's the first thing that actually makes his pain go away. He's able to function again, which is true. Like opiates do actually work on pain in almost every instance. But the thing his doctor didn't tell him, and probably didn't know, was that this is one of the most addictive substances you can possibly take. Fast forwarding, he gets addicted to OxyContin. It goes from a legitimate prescription to I need more. So he's buying pills on the black market. Even that is not enough. And then OxyContin, the formula to OxyContin is changed, which makes it harder to abuse. And then he, like a lot of addicts, switches over to heroin. And then he becomes a heroin addict. And then he loses his job. And by the way, his son is also addicted via his own path, more like the sort of youthful indiscretion path. The two of them end up living in a Subaru in the parking lot of the same factory where Tony once designed airplanes. And they decide to rob a bank. I don't want to give away too much of the story in case people want to listen, but ultimately, let's just say it doesn't go very well. And Tony's life at that point becomes the life of a heroin addicted bank robber. And this podcast tells the story of that unraveling of his life and then everything that happened afterwards. So I talked to him for more than 2 years through the pandemic after he got out of prison. I first started talking to him in prison, and then after he got out of prison, extensively through struggles to try to reenter society and dealing with sobriety and trying to stay on the right path. And it's the subplot is it's a father-son story. And I'm happy to report they're both doing okay today.
Which is amazing considering all that they've been through. For people that don't know a little bit about the Sacklers, and then we'll come back to Tony. Can you tell us why the Sacklers are in so much hot water?
Yeah, so OxyContin is made by a company called Purdue Pharma. I believe it's no longer called Purdue Pharma. But it was a company that started by these guys, the Sackler brothers, who were very talented at advertising pharmaceuticals and then ultimately manufacturing them. And they created a drug called OxyContin, which was far more powerful than any other opiate on the market. It prescribed, I don't know, remember the year that it comes on the market, but sometime in the late 90s and into the early 2000s, it's prescribed. And a lot of people think of it as a miracle drug because it's this very powerful opiate that does help extreme pain. People like Tony, who couldn't get out of bed, suddenly he can get out of bed. You can see why they take it. The dirty secret was that not only was the company aware of how addictive it was, they were also, it seems, allegedly, although I think this is almost proven at this point, a lot of doctors around America essentially became drug dealers. They were prescribing this to people who didn't need it for pain, who were just addicted. So you had these pain clinics, which were nicknamed pill mills, all over America that were fed by Purdue reps who were making a fortune and knew full well that, and this is especially bad in rural America, like poorer areas like West Virginia and all through Appalachia, the Midwest, where if anyone was looking at the numbers of the drug sales, it's very obvious that the state of West Virginia did not need however many million OxyContin. Like, it did not take a genius to look. And of course, Purdue knew that they weren't going to chronic pain sufferers. They were going to addicts. So for years, this is essentially covered up. And when the aftermath of the epidemic, when we saw how many people had died, the Sacklers finally are held accountable through a series of lawsuits, ultimately a class action lawsuit that held them accountable. They were forced to shut the company down and reopen it as something else. They had to find hundreds of millions of dollars, but they made billions. And the people like Tony, who've come out the other side, who were, he considers himself lucky to be alive. Also, his son feels the same way. They don't think the Sacklers have been punished enough, that this family should not be allowed to keep any money, that that someone should be held responsible criminally, and no one has gone to prison.
I know. I try to keep my opinions off the pod somewhat, but I think it's criminal that people can addict people legally with a legal drug, know it, and then just be like, oh, that happened.
And profit from it to the tune of billions.
There's some potential addiction for every drug. I'm not saying that we should hold all these big drug companies accountable, because there's some potential addiction to like every drug, but like to knowingly make it addictive and to knowingly, it's to know what's going on and then do nothing to stop it and then be like, happens, it's your fault. No, that's like,
that. Yeah, I agree. And I think millions of families agree too. That, like I said, Tony's lucky, Connor's the name of his son, lucky to have survived and to be doing okay. Lots of families lost people, sons, daughters, mothers, fathers. And it's not an exaggeration to say that the fentanyl epidemic that we're currently dealing with, which is arguably worse, is a byproduct of the opiate epidemic largely caused by OxyContin. Now, we can't blame OxyContin completely, but it was seemingly the largest factor in the epidemic. A lot of the addicts who survived, who moved on to heroin, to continue to do heroin, are now using fentanyl, is now killing people. Not just addicts, fentanyl is killing children who accidentally pick up the wrong thing because it's so concentrated. So while I don't think it's fair to say the Sacklers are responsible for the fentanyl epidemic, they certainly played a role in creating the addicted hordes who are now using fentanyl. So it's like not enough. It's not like the thing went away just because OxyContin is now controlled much more tightly. So I think historically, we're going to look back on these people as great villains in American history.
First of all, have you watched Painkiller on Netflix?
Not yet. It's in my queue, but I haven't watched it yet. I'm aware of it, though.
I highly recommend it to anybody. It's a fictionalized version, only in that they've changed little things and they have actors playing the people instead of the real people. But it is so appalling what they did to push this drug and to get it approved by the FDA, which is a whole nother thing. And
yeah, and you can, and there's definitely a reason to hold certain people at the FDA accountable. The US government did not do its job in this case. And in fact, when you learn some dirty things about the pharmaceutical business and its interactions with the government, and like several people who worked on the approval of OxyContin ultimately went to work at Purdue Pharma afterwards and profited from it. And I think that happens quite a bit. There's like this private sector government, the people go back and forth sometimes, and that means the government is not always doing its job. And this is just an egregious example. So I definitely plan to watch it.
Yeah, it's amazing. I heard about it on Joe Rogan, because I listen to Joe Rogan once in a while, and this thing's amazing, and it's about the opioid epidemic. So I started watching it, and I'm not a binge watcher. I'll do one episode here and then like another episode 2 days. I had watched all but one in one day and then finished the one the next. I was just spellbound by what these people did, and I'm like, what in the world?
Totally, I know.
So what was it like when you first met Tony in prison?
I've done other stories with convicts, and I've corresponded with people in prison. And what's amazing about Tony is that almost from the very first communication, if I could go back and find the email, he was just so incredibly honest. He's likable for one thing. If I've listened to the podcast, you obviously know there's something very approachable and charming and also vulnerable. He's not willing or he's not afraid to talk about the worst moments of his life in ways that are not flattering at all. And he was,
He
you know, and so
definitely doesn't have a filter. Like,
he does
he.
not. No, you're right. And as
No.
a journalist, that's a gift because everybody, when you want to aspire to tell someone's story, you expect them to keep certain things from you. And this was a guy who was just willing. And I think it was, he described it to me, maybe even on the podcast, as a kind of therapy to him. I think he felt very guilty for what he had done, even though it wasn't his fault that Connor had gotten addicted. They did use together for a while, and I think he'll live with that guilt forever. So some part of being honest was atoning for that and holding himself responsible by telling his story and understanding that people were going to judge him for it. But I also just think he's one of those people who isn't afraid to tell you the bad parts. And yeah, it was incredibly refreshing. So like it did not take me, usually when I often do these projects where I spend months, if not a year or years, talking to an individual or a couple individuals. And it takes a while usually to get them comfortable with you because the journalist source relationship is weird. You've always got a tape recorder or a pen. They know everything they say. You're either writing down or memorizing. And so there's always this artificiality about it. With Tony, that's basically never existed. He just talked to me and told me whatever I wanted to hear, and including the bad parts. And the stuff with his son is harrowing. And obviously there are people who will listen to that and think you're a bad person. And he understands that. I think there's nothing I can ever do to change it. I would not apologize for it. All I can tell you is in that moment, it felt like the right thing. I would rather be using with my son than him using on his own. And Connor said the same thing about his dad. I interviewed them separately. He said the exact same thing. He said, I understand people will be mad at my dad. I blame myself. But I felt like if he was on his own, he's likely to end up dead. So at least we can look out for each other. And even Connor's mom and Tony's ex-wife, unsung hero of the story, she's very magnanimous about it in retrospect and has a good relationship with Tony and obviously was very mad at him at certain times, understandably. But now is able to, that she appreciates the story of the addiction and what OxyContin was and what happened to them, has been able to let go of all that anger and hurt, and now just wants them to be okay. She's moved on, she's remarried, she's got a good life, but she wants Tony to do well and obviously wants Connor to do well. It was a gift of a story in that sense. It really connected with people. I think either you knew the opioid epidemic too well and it felt good to hear somebody else's story, or like a lot of people, including myself, I knew it, but I didn't really understand it. And then I lived this story for 2 years and I came out the other side with a completely different understanding of what this was.
And that's what it was for me too. I was like, wow, to hear from the family and like how much they changed and all that stuff. I'm like, one little drug can just destroy everything. And it's crazy. It's just crazy how this family destroyed millions and millions of people's lives. And
I know. And I think probably this show, I would say like this is the show resonated in a way that nothing else. I've made some very popular stuff. Some of these crime shows we do are like have huge audiences, but I never got as much mail, like emails. And if you read the reader reviews on Apple or listener reviews on Apple Podcasts, they're very gratifying. Not because they're telling me I'm talented or anything, but because they're like, this story really moved me. And I felt like privileged to have told it because I think part of what we're doing is entertainment, but a big part of journalism is trying to make a difference or trying to tell stories of people who wouldn't otherwise be heard or to bring to light the kinds of things we need to be thinking about and talking about. And I think this story had all that. And then that's just thanks to Tony being.
Yeah, Tony is great. Tony's funny. I'm like, Tony's, I was funny. Laughing at Tony. He was like, just, he would tell you how it was. And it was very refreshing to hear, oh yeah, that I sucked at that.
Yeah. And he had a good sense of humor about even the worst stuff. Now, he also was emotional. You heard it. He cried at times. He was quite mad at times. But considering what he'd been through, pretty incredible spirits, I would say.
Can you tell me about just, first of all, how Tony would rob these banks? And then about him going to prison and struggling to reenter society and some of the stuff that came with that?
Sure. Tony was an engineer. He designed airplanes, like I said, galleys, but parts of airplanes. He was an engineer by trade. So he's a very analytical, detail-oriented person. And so when he started robbing banks, it was only to fuel his addiction. So it's not like the kinds of heists we imagine from movies where it's a gang and they wear special masks and they rob $10 million from an armored car or a vault. He was like going into banks, robbing tellers for a few thousand bucks a pop, basically to fuel his addiction. And he realized that as long as he covered his face and hands so that he wouldn't be seen on the camera or leave DNA evidence behind, and he worked really quickly, he could get away with it. And I think he got cocky. He thought almost indefinitely. He did rob 30 banks in just over a year because he would study the getaway route. So he would rob banks that had a clear getaway that were near an interstate so that he only had to make a few turns and be on the highway. So it'd be very hard to pursue him. And if he was in and out, it just takes the police, even the fastest police, unless they happen to be driving by, it's going to take them 5-10 minutes. And if he's in and out in a minute, and if you're only trying to get what's in the teller's drawer, it's very doable. The only risk that remains in that scenario, other than a cop having to drive by, is like someone trying to be a hero. And Tony didn't want to carry a weapon. That was important to him. He was not there to hurt people. It was, even in his darkest moments, he tried to have a moral compass. Now, like, no one is going to justify, I'm certainly not trying to justify robbing banks, and neither is he.
No, but it does show that he only wanted to fuel his addiction and had no desire to hurt anybody else.
Yeah, exactly. And it was very important to him. So that's why he didn't want to carry a weapon. He didn't want to have to touch any, like physically, you know, get in a fight. So he was actually quite afraid of the hero customer who might stand up to him, or a guard who happened to be, he didn't notice. And that, unfortunately, I think there was only one case where someone even started to, and it didn't, he had to run away. So he was pursued at one time by a customer. But other than that, he would get away with a few thousand bucks, and that would cover his addiction for a week or two, and then he'd have to do it again. And it was basically a full-time job, exhausting and stressful. And when you think about the risks that you go through to rob 30 banks, and I think his total for all the robberies was like $70,000. So he made like a middle-class income, putting himself at risk there. Because anytime you rob a bank, you could be shot, right? Like there could be a person inside carrying a concealed weapon. A cop could come in and get like all kinds of risk. And that also speaks to the desperation of the addict. Once he lost his job, he needed to support his habit. And this is a really important thing to think about, to know about opioid addiction, is that, and it's something I learned, I guess maybe I knew it on some level, but I didn't totally understand this until Tony talked me through it, which is like, we think of drug addicts as chasing a high. Like, that's the public general perception of, and it's why we look down on addicts, I think. Like, oh, they're just out for pleasure. They should just not do that because that's selfish. With opiates, it's not the high that they're chasing. They're trying to evade the low. And it's when you're addicted on that level and you don't have access to the drugs, the crash, as described by Tony and subsequently many others, is like the worst sickness you've ever had. It's so miserable that you will do anything to not experience it, which explains a lot, right? You're like, how could a guy with a great job end up addicted to heroin, living in a car, robbing banks? That's it. He basically was like, I will do anything to not have to feel that way. And it really puts a different spin on addiction where you're like, this is not about people who are trying to go out and have a good time. They were not like shooting heroin and going to clubs. He was trying to not feel like death. And it's really tragic to think how many people out there are living that experience even today, that that's what your life becomes. And you, he said, you really start to set your life. Your clock is just, when's my next fix? When's my next fix? When's my next? And you're constantly living in panic of, I know in 4 hours, now 3 hours, now 2 hours, now 1 hour, if I don't have money to score, I'm going to go into withdrawal and I'm going to want to die. And it's not, when you think of what that life is like, it's pretty bad.
And withdrawal is like the flu times 1,000.
Yeah, that's what people will tell you, that the worst you've ever felt, the thing, like when you are in bed and just rolling around groaning, thinking, I'd almost rather be dead. That's what it feels like. And it's predictable, right? What's coming. When we get sick, we don't know it's coming. It just happens to us. And we know intellectually we're going to get better eventually, hopefully. But in this case, you're like, it's coming and I know it's coming and I know when it's coming and I know what it's going to feel like. Therefore, I have to stop it. Imagine if the worst flu you've ever had and you know it's coming tonight at 5 o'clock, but you could stop it if you do this thing. But you would definitely do almost anything for that thing because you're like, I don't want to feel that way again. And yet, of course, that is not a story that ends well for anyone. There aren't a lot of stories of people who live with an opiate addiction for 20, 10, 20, 30 years. You almost always end up dead. I think in Tony's case, getting arrested saved his life. After his 30th bank robbery, he's caught, he's arrested, he goes to prison. He goes through withdrawal in King County Jail in Seattle under horrible conditions. Sounds just like some of the worst days of anyone's life. But gets sober, focuses on his case, understands he needs to go to prison, is not fighting, but basically doesn't want to go to prison for the rest of his life. He starts to feel like, I deserve to be punished. I'm not doubting that. But I don't think this was all my fault. I didn't hurt anybody. Therefore, I would like to do the least amount of time possible. So he spends 2 years in King County Jail. Jails are meant to help house people between arrest and conviction. They're short-term storage facilities. You don't have private room. You don't have your private bathroom. You're like in there with drunk and drug addicted and dangerous people. Most people want to get out of there and go to prison as quickly as they can. Because in prison, you get your own room. You get a TV. The food is better. It's not great, but it's way better than jail. Tony spent 2 years in jail trying to get his cases reduced so that once he goes to prison, he won't have to spend 20 years there. He can come out and still be a grandfather who's youngish, and it succeeds. So he only did, I think, in total 5 years, including those 2 years.
And so what were some of the struggles for him reentering society?
I think I learned a lot of things from this story. And again, we've all heard that it's difficult for ex-cons, that... And it's similar, I think, to the way we look at addicts. So if there's one thing I hope this story does, it's change the way we look at addicts. But I would also say I hope it changes the way we look at people who go to prison, which is not everybody who goes to prison. In fact, most people who go to prison are not like irredeemable monsters, rapists, murderers. A lot of them are people who've just made really bad decisions. And we shouldn't condemn them forever to a life of misery in prison, let alone when they get out. And what happens when they come out, and I think this is the case with Tony and certainly millions and millions of people, is that you have this scarlet letter, like, I'm a felony ex-con. In Tony's case, a guy who robbed 30 banks. And so employers are not looking kindly at that. And I think we don't do a lot to support ex-con. There are definitely programs, and I think certain cities and states are better than others, and probably there are plenty of people out there in the nonprofit world who care about this. In practice, what happens is you come out and nobody wants to hire you, or you can get a job. But think of a guy who was basically designing airplanes and now he's like struggling to get a job working at a gas station. And not that there's anything wrong with working at a gas station, but you're going to make a lot less money than he used to make, and not a lot of stability and not a lot of benefits. And I think it's sad that we let people go committed a crime, but then you should come out and be able to be like, I did something bad. I was punished for it. But now, like, why do I have to keep being punished for it? And I think in his case, again, he's an amazing individual in the sense that he doesn't complain about it a lot. He doesn't seem super resentful, bummed. He would like to go back. I always thought the best PR story in the world for Boeing would be that they should hire him back and tell that story publicly. Here's a guy who worked here, was a valuable employee, went through the worst, became a bad person, or arguably, and now is here again, like showing that you can go through something like this and come out the other side and still be a valuable member of society and a team. Like he could certainly do what he was doing before just as well. And I think he would do it for half the money, frankly. I think he would just, at this point, almost go back to starting salary and just say, I understand I can't have my big job back, but like, just give me a chance.
I know. And I guess their thinking is, and you can't have people that could potentially relapse working on airplanes and stuff, but how long has it been? What?
Over 10. Oh, since he worked at Boeing, it's now been over 10 years, I think.
Like, so since it's like last hit of.
Oh, yeah. Over 5, 6 years, I think. I mean, certainly a long enough period that we could reasonably assume he's okay.
Yeah. After 5 years, there's so much less chance of relapse.
Exactly. Yeah. Most people relapse within a few months, if not a year. And I think, but as long as you, I think, and I don't know, I've never been addicted to opiates, but what I hear is so much of it is about triggers and staying away, keeping yourself out of the situations in which you might relapse. And I did another story. This was a print story 10 years or so ago about a gang of Canadian bank robbers. And the only surviving one was also an opiate addict. And he was in a good place when I talked to him, but then ultimately he relapsed and died. And I think Tony is so well aware of that possibility that he'll never put himself back in it. I think he worries more about Connor, and I'm pretty confident about Connor too, but Connor's much younger. A younger person is more likely to end up in a situation where you could be exposed to something and make a bad decision in a moment. Yeah, I don't think Boeing would have anything to worry about with Tony. He's not, in my opinion, a huge relapse risk. And if we're, and I'm sure this is true of addicts in general, if we're worried about trying to help people stay sober, the longer that they don't have jobs, the less they have to live for.
And then they spiral down because they don't have anything to keep them distracted, right? Or any kind of purpose, I guess.
Yeah, you heard it in Hooked, right? Like, Tony doesn't go back to heroin, but he starts drinking alcohol, and suddenly, sure enough, he's like basically an alcoholic, and fortunately got a hold of it and recognized it and was like, okay, I'm not living this story again. But what do you almost can't blame somebody who's stuck at home with no prospects and trying to do the right thing, but unable to through no fault of your own. I think he applies for jobs. I've written letters for him. Now I think last time I talked to him, he started to do a little public speaking. He wants to create a nonprofit that would help addicts. Like, he could go and speak to schools and prisons. And I think that would be great.
Yeah, I would love to help out with that too. If they need like a social media person or something.
Okay. Yeah, I'll pass on. I should check. You're talking about it now reminds me that I need to check in on him. It's been a few months. And he was applying for some grant money with the state of Washington, I think. Part of the Sackler settlement is that most of that money goes to the states. And depending on how many cases or how big their problem was, the states get money allocated based on that. And so I think Washington State had some kind of program where he was going to apply for a grant to maybe get started. Yeah, I'll let you know what I find out.
Yeah, that would definitely be something that I would like to help out with if I could. So anything else you want to add?
No, I'm always happy to talk about this story. And I hope people who, whether you've experienced this epidemic and just want to hear, you know, I say it has a happy ending, and I think it does because they're both alive and well today. Not addicted to, I wish it had a happier ending, and hopefully it still will someday. But I think it's especially important for people to listen to the show. And it's like nothing here is like a sales pitch for me as, oh, I want more downloads for my podcast. It's that I think this is such a crisis in America and the world that if you don't understand it, it's very hard to be helpful or to, even if helpful is just being empathetic. I like to think I'm a more empathetic person because of it, having judge addicts differently. And I think that's really important because vilifying addicts is part of what creates the problem, because They have to live in the shadows. They make bad decisions. Family members like cast them out. Law enforcement treats them poorly. And it's a disease, right? That's not a euphemism. It is legitimately a disease. Your body cannot function without these substances. And I think one of the powers of the show is that it takes you inside somebody's life and you come out and think, wow, that could happen to me or my brother or my dad. And without that kind of understanding, it's very easy to just say, oh, those are bad people. That just happens to the bad people. Well, that's not true, right? That's definitely not true.
Yeah, that's definitely not true. It can happen to anybody, really. Any other projects you've got coming up?
Well, my company camps, we're making a lot of podcasts. So almost every month we've got something coming out. I'm working on one at the moment that I can't really talk about yet, but hopefully my next show will be out in the spring sometime. Very different story. This is like the common thread for me is that every project is very different because I did before it hooked. I made a show called Chameleon, Hollywood Con Queen, which is about a con artist. And then before that was The Clearing, which was about the daughter of a serial killer trying to reckon with her father's legacy. Then I made one about a screenwriter who disappeared and perhaps was involved with the CIA. My next one, I would say, is set in the world of financial crime and colonialism.
Yes, and you are such a great narrator. And so I cannot wait to hear like what you do next because you find the weirdest stories.
Thank you.
And I mean that as a compliment.
I take it as a compliment. It's always what happens to fascinate me in the moment. And often that is just like the strangest stories. But they're always at the heart. They're stories about people. I'm like, well, what makes these things good is that the people that they're about are willing to tell you their stories for one thing, but also have lived interesting lives.
So where can people follow you on social media?
I think my handle on almost everything is JoshDean66, which I was just randomly the Yahoo address given to me a long time ago. There's no significance to it. And then my company is Campside Media. Yeah, I think we're just Campside Media on most stuff. And if you like this show, I would say it's indicative of the kind of shows we make, which are these 8, 6 to 10 part stories about really interesting, surprising people and events. So yeah, happy to have new listeners all the time.
Yes, hopefully we'll get you at least one or two. We don't have very many listeners, but hopefully we'll get at least one or two. Thank you so much for coming on. We will include all the links to follow all the things in the show notes, and we will see you guys next episode. Bye, guys.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to follow the show and our guests on social media and subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app using the links in the show notes. Please remember to rate and review us. See you next time.